Trying new ideas on the farm, especially those that involve innovative approaches, will not always be easily understood by neighbors or other people who might drive by. But for those willing to follow their own curiosity and their own thinking, the benefits can far outweigh the costs.
A lot of people look what I do, and I'm sure they don't say it in my face, but they think I'm crazy. You know, it can't be done. I want to tell people it can be done. No-till cover crops is not easy. You know, a lot of people expect, you know, just to go out there and have a prescription. You do this at a certain time and everything works just right. With cover crops, you got to manage even better. So it's a challenge and it takes time. But I do believe the benefits are good enough to keep working at it.
Illinois farmer Gary Acey talks about his farming system that combines no-till, cover crops, and hog manure, and the lessons he's learned over the years about what it takes to build healthier soils. This is the Soil Sense Podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hello there. Thank you so much for tuning into Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is my co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down with Gary Acey. Gary farms in Henry County, which is in northwest Illinois, not far from the Quad Cities. He's been in continuous no-till for over 20 years now and started incorporating cover crops back in 2010. Gary began raising hogs as a kid in 4-H, and after many years in that business, he finally sold his hog operation recently to a young farmer getting into the business for the first time. But he still uses the manure from that operation as a major source of fertilizer for his farm. There's a lot of hard-earned wisdom in this episode with Gary, and I thought a good place to start was his path to getting into no-till and the impact that decision has had on the rest of his farming operation.
Going way back to the 80s when the government started telling us on highly erodible ground we needed to start doing something different, we started experimenting with no-till then. We have moved along the time frame of continually using more. And, you know, back as about 2000 or 2001, we used it mainly, did a little bit of tillage at times. But since about 2009 or so, we haven't done that. Or actually, 2003, we haven't done any tillage at all.
And what was the learning like in those first, 20 plus years of no-till to kind of get to that point? It sounds like maybe you started small and then kind of spread it throughout other acreages. So maybe share those early lessons.
We started small back in the 1980s. We tried a little patch of no-till corn on corn. And of course, it turned out to be a drought year. So that was rather interesting. The ground had been tilled for years and really wasn't in shape for no-till, and it was a learning period there. It was a struggle. It started out in the dry year. It wasn't the good results, but we kept trying and working at it. And beginning was mainly no-till soybeans, but we progressed on to no-tilling corn and the bean stubble too. But it's been a learning curve. So,
what were you seeing that kind of kept you committed to, you know, you kind of got to stay in the game long enough to get those learnings, it sounds like. So what kind of kept you in the game?
Conserving the soil was a big one. You keep the soil in place, nutrients in place, less passes over the field. When I was in high school and first started farming, you know, we turned every acre black in the spring with a mowboard plow. It took a lot of time, a lot of effort to do that. With no-till fully effective, we save a lot of machinery and time, plus saving that soil.
And what'd your neighbors think?
Some neighbors were trying some of the same things, but I've done numerous things over the years that neighbors have thought of crazy. But if you work, keep at it and work at it, your soil and the microbiome and the soil adjust and do a good job. And also, I add my father was one of the first ones in the 70s to buy a chisel plow, which was an advancement for us at the time, you know, going from completely turning everything over to a chisel plow in the fall. It was a step in the process.
Okay. You know, I'd like to talk about, you made the comment earlier about the microbiome. Maybe if you could just talk generally about, you know, how are you thinking about your soil microbiome or assessing how that's going for you?
Back in the early days when we started no-till, that wasn't even on the radar at the time. Now, my current farming practices, I'm no-tilling, I'm using cover crops, I'm using manure as my major source of fertilizer, and microbiome in the soil is on my radar now. I've taken some soil tests to see what's there and try to enhance it and use some biological products to see if we can enhance the microbiome. But I feel more and more that it's very important to keep that microbiome and the soil healthy and working for you.
So what was it that made you such a big fan of the soil microbiome? Because it's tough to see. So how did you know that system was starting to work for you or that you needed to care about it?
Well, it's a part of the system which isn't actually part of the microbiome is seeing the earthworms. As I progressed along, you know, especially in the spring when it was cooler, you know, every time I dig on the soil, I was turning up earthworms and they're, you know, seeing the holes in the soil from the earthworms that they leave. It tells me that, you know, there's a lot going on underground and the microbiomes are a part you can't really see, but they have added advanced benefits there too. But the earthworms is kind of what clued me in to start thinking about what's underneath the soil.
Yeah. And I take it since you had hogs sort of off and on for a long time, were you always using manure as a big part of your nutrient management program?
Yes. Back in the older days before I had the modern buildings, you know, it was mainly a dry spreading of manure. And, you know, it was kind of, well, let's spread on this 40 this year and, you know, kind of spread in this spot in the next year. And we really didn't take. Now I take samples of the manure to see what's in the manure, sample the soil, and apply using the monitor. In the past with the dry spreader, it was just kind of spread and pick a certain gear in the tractor and that's take off. So that's changed quite a bit.
I guess some of the logistics with manure can be daunting for some farmers. And so what is your farm size and what is the spread or the distance that you're going, you know, with that manure to apply? Do you hit every field or you just do the ones that are kind of close by?
I currently farm 300 acres myself. The barns on the site here are two 2480s. There's manure that goes on the neighbor's fields. We try to apply as closely as possible. It cuts some time, but you know, some manure does go down the road over a mile to be spread. But not trying to over-apply. We want to get the best use of those nutrients without over-applying, so that sometimes means going down the road a ways. But yeah, it takes time. And, you know, it's a certain time of the year where it works best. So.
And you mentioned not over-applying and kind of testing soil, testing the manure. Are you using any sort of kind of precision placement as well?
With a manure, I apply the manure in a strip. It's a minimum disturbance applicator. It has a wavy colander and the manure comes in behind. A small disc throws on top. And my goal is to plant back on top of that strip with the corn in the spring. So those nutrients are all right there for the corn to find very easily.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about the cover crops. What got you interested in cover crops? Because it sounds like they came quite a while after the no-till.
Yes. First fall I seeded in the cover crops was fall 2010. My main reason back then was I was applying manure and highly rollable ground, so I wanted to help hold that soil in place and those nutrients in place. And I experimented with some cereal rye and perennial rye that fall. It was a learning process. The cereal rye came good. The perennial rye never emerged because I found out I planted it too late. But the cereal rye has been a mainstay for my operation since then. I've used it exclusively for a while. Now I've gone to where I use rye in front of soybeans, and I use wheat and winter barley ahead of corn. And sometimes I'll mix some other species in there that just try to get a little bit of variety in there.
And so what was the use wheat and winter barley before corn? What's the reasoning behind that?
First time I, you know, used wheat behind corn, I went to my dealer who had been getting everything through, and he didn't have any rye at the time. So he said, let's try some wheat. So I planted some wheat. I liked it. Going ahead of corn, it doesn't produce quite as much above ground mass as what rye does. It does a good job of soaking up the nutrients and holding the soil in place, but it doesn't have all that biomass on top, which can be a problem when you're planting corn behind a cover crop. So that's the reason I've stuck with the wheat, and also the barley is kind of similar. It's not a real big plant, but it kind of gives a little diversity to the plant there.
Do you have to worry about nutrient tie-up or anything like that? Or has your nitrogen plan changed since you have cover crops before corn?
Well, yes, especially with the rye head corn, you got to worry about nutrient tie-up. When I first started this combination of the manure, the cover crops, and the corn, I was actually applying a little bit of nitrogen with the planter just to get that corn crop off to a good start. Then one year, we tried a few strips without that nitrogen on the planter, and they actually yielded better than where we put the nitrogen on the planter. So after that point, I quit applying any extra nitrogen. My theory is I've got the microbiome going there and the nutrient cycling going there, that I have nutrients available early in the spring now and not worrying about that tie-up from that cover crop. The organic matter in the soils I farm on have gone up consistently year after year, and I think that also helps with the availability of the nutrients early there.
And you found a good fit with cereal rye and with the winter wheat, winter barley. And did you try any other cover crops that you thought were kind of interesting, or have you stick mostly with the grasses?
I've put in some crimson clover at times, and tried some winter canola this time around. My trouble is with the elder species, trying to get them to grow and survive the winter from when I plant, because I plant the cover crops after harvest, and you know, those other species don't always get a good start.
And as you reflect on the last 13 years or so with cover crops and the no-till, what has surprised you, or what would you say are the biggest sort of lessons or takeaways that you'd want to share with other farmers interested in developing a similar system?
Well, the combination, you know, as I said before, I started mainly to hold that soil in place, you know, and I discovered, you know, it helped with nutrient cycling. You know, those cover crops would soak up some of those nutrients and release them later in the year. The microbiology has improved. I've seen organic matter raise on the soils. The general tilth and the health of the soil seems better. And I still have trouble with weeds, but they don't seem to be as thick as what they were before I started using the cover crops and no-till. It does help in suppression of the weeds.
I was wondering about your weed management plan since you brought it up. What does that look like as far as pre-emerge and post-emerge? Did you have to change your herbicide applications for your cover crop plan?
Yeah. Before cover crops, you know, usually put out a pre-emerge out there for residual and then come back with others as needed. Now with the cover crops, I mainly come out with a Roundup when I want to terminate the cover crop. I have experimented a little bit with a crimper going into beans. I haven't had too much success with that yet, but haven't given up hope on that. But again, the Roundup is the initial kill the cover crop, and then come back with my residual herbicides and other ones after that cover crop has died back.
Yeah, I think a crimper can be kind of tricky, because don't you have to have three breaks in that stem to get it to actually kill the rye?
And yeah, the rye has to be mature enough. And even off the first time I tried it, I just had no type specified rye. And I think there were several varieties of rye in there. It wasn't all at the same stage. I've gone to an earlier season rye trying to help with that. But the dry year this spring also changed my plans. I was planning on doing that, and I planted my beans into the rye green, and I was noticing it was getting very dry there. So I terminated that cover crop a lot earlier than what I would have liked to, just to try to save some moisture. That's can be a problem with cover crops in a dry year, but you got to work with it and manage it.
And so how closely are you watching those fields where you have rye? Are you out there all the time, you know, digging up the soil, seeing what the moisture is, or what's your recommendation?
Once I plant a crop, if I'm home, I'm out in the field that day at some point looking at the crops. And I also, this year I hired a scout for an extra set of eyes out there. It comes once a week and walks through my fields for me. But yeah, I spend time out in my fields. I heard from some very smart grain farmers, the best thing to see in a field is your shadow.
And I love asking this question to farmers because for each one it's different. But what equipment modifications or equipment considerations did you have to make when you made the transition to no-till and then again to using cover crops?
To the no-till, had to set the planter up different. You had to, buy heavier planters, better planters, which, we're fortunate. Those have been come along the line. To plant my soybeans and cover crops, so I use a Kinze planter on 15-inch rows. Got no-till coulters and changed the closers on it, and, make sure there's plenty of down pressure available there. I like the cover crops in 15-inch rows. With a planter, you get a lot better seed contact, and those cover crops will come up quicker in the spring. In the corn ground, I use a IH planter. It's set up with a lot of different attachments on there to get that corn off to a good start in the right place. So a lot of modifications, especially on the corn planter. And do some things in furrow injection to help get those plants off to a good start.
Okay, so I picked up in there that you plant your rye on 15-inch rows with the planter. And so you're planting the rye in strips. Are you coming back in between those strips and planting your crop, or how are you doing that?
My goal for the corn is to come in and plant those cover crops in between the rows. Well, actually, the soybeans don't have to worry about it, but I plant there and then apply the manure in between those strips of the cover crop and then plant the corn on top of the cover crop. It can be a challenge to get everything to line up right, but that's my goal. I may have to start planting my cover crops at an angle going in the corn and then, applying the manure and just coming back with a planter to follow those manure strips. Because each one of the tractors has a different monitor and GPS, and it's hard to get them all to talk to each other.
Of course, right? Why would they all talk to each other and make this easy for you, right?
Yeah, especially since each one's a different brand, so...
On the topic of equipment, is there anything else that you've looked at or are looking at for adding to your operation in the future?
No, the cover crop crimper is the latest piece I've added and trying to get that incorporated in there. You want to make sure you have a good sprayer available when you need it. I still do most of my spraying, and mainly because I watch closely, and when it's time to spray, it's time to spray. Don't want to be on somebody's list somewhere. But the main thing is have good planter that's equipped to handle the residue and get no-till conditions and a good sprayer. And of course, everybody needs a combine in the end. So.
Absolutely. Well, over the years, has there been a time where you almost decided it wasn't worth it? The challenges either with no-till, with cover crops, or kind of soil health journey in general that you decided, boy, this is just not working, and almost quit.
There are times, especially early in no-till, that it was a challenge to keep going. When switching over, you can have compaction, and it's kind of hard to do. I have done some subsoiling in the past to kind of help with that, but I haven't done any of that in quite some time. In the cover crops, it's a learning experience. I've had some times when things haven't gone the way I wanted, but I've never called it a failure. It's a learning experience.
And what about what you're seeing in your fields versus other fields nearby, both in wet years and then now in a dry year?
What I see, and not so much earlier, but especially in a dry year, I see my crops where I have the no-till and the cover crops and manure that will hold on longer than a conventionally tilled or even a no-till farm nearby. That structure and the microbiome seems to help that plant thrive a little longer in dry conditions. In wet conditions, there's been some falls when we go to harvest when it's been quite wet. The ground has been no-till and cover crops is somewhat firm, and that combine will ride on top. If you got a tilled field, that combine will sink down to that tillage layer and leave ruts through your field. So that's an advantage there too.
You mentioned that your dad had bought a chisel plow in the 70s, and then you started no-tilling in the 80s. And what does the future look like on your farm? I don't know if you have kids or not that are going to take over the farm, but is this conservation mindset, what does it look like in the future?
I have a couple daughters that, follow the farm closely, but that's not going to be their career. But recently sold the hog buildings off to a young neighbor who's getting started in farming. And I hope that either him or some other young farmer in the area that can farm these soils way I do, or take lessons from me going forward to help protect the soil. That's what I hope to provide as a legacy there.
So was it important that those go to someone kind of young and up and coming that you could help get a leg up?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's hard for young people to get started in farming. Plenty of farmers, which I don't blame any of them, that, you know, I'm one myself, I could be retired at this point, but I still farm because I like what I'm doing and I'm able to do it. And there's farmers older than me still farming. And I do not, you know, fault anybody for doing that, but also we need to find a way for younger people to get in to the farming and find ways where younger farmers can be there while the older farmers are still enjoying what they're doing yet too. So.
And along similar lines to Abby's question about kind of the future, what are the biggest questions you're still asking yourself regarding your soil and building healthier soils? What questions are you wondering about?
How I can continue to benefit from microbes in the soil. I've tried several products that stimulate the microbes in the soil. It's kind of hard to see for sure how much they benefit you. My goal is to get away totally from any commercial fertilizer. I still supplement the manure with some other products to keep my soil test in line, but my goal is to be able to eliminate those entirely as I go forward here.
I was thinking that the conversation around soil health is so different from that around yield or, you know, sometimes fertilizer inputs or what you're doing with regards to that. And what makes you want to share your message about what you're doing related to soil health?
I like to share any, you know, it's a lot of people look what I do and I'm sure they don't say it in my face, but they think I'm crazy. You know, it can't be done. I want to tell people it can be done. No-till cover crops is not easy. You know, a lot of people expect, you know, just to go out there and have a prescription. You do this at a certain time and everything works just right. With cover crops, you got to manage even better. And no-till and manure. So it's a challenge and it takes time. But I do believe the benefits are good enough to keep working at it.
On the topic of yield, do you feel like you've had to sacrifice yield to pursue soil health? And just curious about how you've approached that or thought about that.
I don't feel I've given up much of any yield. There may be a year or two here along the line where my yields may not be as quite as good as conventional fields. But also, I feel there's years that my fields are actually better because of the soil health and the culture in the soil and the manure nutrients. In extremely dry years, I've seen my fields stay greener than the ones around me. So, you know, some years are better, some years are worse. It's something you got to work through.
Well, if we had you in front of a room of farmers that were earlier in their soil health journey than you, maybe they're just getting into reducing tillage or thinking about cover crops, you know, what would be your advice to them or what would be your message to them to kind of get to the point where you're seeing the amount of benefits you are at this point in your soil health journey?
Don't give up easily. Don't go 100% all at once. Work into it. Take it in steps. And have a part of your farm where you push the boundaries. If you don't push the boundaries, you don't know how far you can go. I know a high-yield farmer, sometimes he said when he's working on something, well, I'm trying to see what it takes to kill the crop. Then I can back off and know what helps. You know, I don't go that far, but you got to push the boundaries to know how far you can go and what benefits might be.
And I know you said when you tried cover crops, there were a couple others in the county that maybe were doing it as well. What's that look like today? Is this a lot more common of a practice in your area?
I see more and more people trying it. It still isn't where I would like to see it, but there are more farmers trying it. I do a little bit of custom planting of cover crops in the fall for a few farmers trying to help them out to try it and see how it works. A couple of years ago, there's a farmer in the 70s that he planted his first cover crop ever and planted no-till beans behind it. You know, he was still learning, so he's willing to give it a try.
That's great. Well, Gary, how about on your end? Anything else that you want to mention on a podcast about your soil health journey?
It's been an interesting journey, something, you know, I want to continue to work at. I think it's been rewarding, and I keep trying to convince more people to try it. I realize it's more management of time, but again, I think it can pay off.
One last question I just thought of. Is there any person or any entity that has really provided you a lot of support or value kind of in you trying to figure all this stuff out?
Well, Sustainable Environmental Consultants are doing reports through the Pork Checkoff on what we're doing on the farms. That they give me a report every year for the practices and show me what I'm doing. As far as conserving soil and greenhouse gas emissions and carbon storage and stuff like that. And I also do work with one company on carbon credits. So, you know, trying to work throughout what's available. And it's still a new program here. It's hard to find sources on things. I have gone to the National No-Till Conference last year, plan to again, and you know, a lot of good information presented there by producers are far more advanced than what I am.
All right, well, that's going to do it for today's episode. Thank you very much to Gary for those resources and for his willingness to share really all of those lessons about building healthier soils. We're going to leave links in the show notes for some of those that he mentioned there. And I'd also encourage you to go check out the Farmers for Soil Health website over at farmersforsoilhealth.com. And before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring the Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. The show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe and follow this show on your favorite podcast app, and go ahead and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.